And tonight's event is Enrico Palandri. And I'd like you to welcome, please, Enrico Palandri, and introducing and chairing the evening, Loredana Palazzi.
I hope you can hear me clearly. Is that okay? Yes. Right. It's a pleasure to introduce Enrico, not only because he is, I feel, becoming a bit of a friend as we meet again and again, but also because he is an experiment here. He is our first non-English writer to be invited to the Writers of Warwick program, and I hope there will be many to follow. So I hope this will be the introduction to a nice and very lucky series. Now, Enrico is Italian, was born in Italy, in Venice, and studied at Bologna University, where, even before finishing university, he managed to write and publish what became quite a bestseller, Boccalone, his first novel. Since then, he has written other novels. He's also written for newspapers and worked on scripts for cinema and translated. And he has also, for a number of years now, been moving between England and Italy. He is writer in residence at University College London, where he has been teaching for a few years now. And he manages to spend, whether it's a blessing or not, I don't know, about half of the year in Britain and half of the year in Italy. I think what I'd like to do is start the evening by having a little chat with you and asking you, first of all, what this moving between cultures and moving between languages has done, both to you as a person, but also to your writing.
Right. I think that the good thing which happened immediately as I came here, I was only 23 the first time I arrived to live in England. The good thing is that it compelled me to separate the Italian, which is the language in which I write, from the language with which I buy bread and chat and do everything, because Italian became a language for writing and a language also which belongs to a kind of solitude. I'm not a lonely person in general. I always like being with people, and it's very important to talk. But when I write, and when I write in Italian in England, something happens which is different. It means that I had to develop a language which is a strange language, which doesn't move exactly with the pace of these exchanges, of being with other people, but it's something different. And also, I think there is a good influence from English, which I hope that I can control somehow. English is a much less rhetorical language than Italian. Italian has we have this problem, I won't bore you with this, but we have this problem of the two languages. We've always had the problem of two languages in Italian, a language for literature and a spoken language. And I think I grew into the literary language through living in England. And there is also probably some syntax and some problems that are linguistic that come from the English, and that are now the problem that I must control. But this is another, how can I say, another push, something that gives me another task, something that I have to do in Italian, is trying to write in Italian, which is Italian and believable Italian, although a lot of the language I speak is English.
Now, besides the language, there's also a very strong presence of these two countries and the two different cultures in the topics or in the subjects of your novels. There is a very strong sense of location, for instance. And your first novel was in Bologna. You could really move with this group of students and with your protagonist through the squares and the streets of Bologna. Later on, London definitely features, as well as Rome or Venice, which is your hometown. And again, when you write, how important is your location? Is moving between these different experiences?
Yes, I think that probably in general, throughout my books, there is a problem of both of seeking to belong, of attempting to belong to place, and this is what I build, I think, in each individual book. I try to belong and to go and live in the place where I set the scene of the stories, and a problem of uprooting, which I think is a more historical one. I think I've become strongly European as a sensitivity because of this, because I've been moving back and forth, and I need to create a context in which where Italian, my Italianness and the Englishness do not repel each other, but somehow talk to each other, are coalesced in some way. And well, this is exactly what the chapter I want to read to you is about, in fact.
Now, the chapter comes from this book, which is The Way Back in English, and in Italian was La Via del Ritorno. And you're going to read from the translation.
Yes, which is a challenge for me because my English is... And I warn you that I think I'll miss some age.
Now, before you go ahead...
For sure. I hope you'll have patience. It's...
No, before you go ahead and read from it, the last question I wanted to ask you is, you are going to read from a translation, so your work has been translated, not only in English, and you have also translated yourself. You've been a translator. What are your feelings towards translation? Is it, in a sense, is it only a necessary evil, or is it...
No, evil, not at all. I mean, I'm very pleased that somebody takes the bother of translating these two books that have appeared in English. Obviously, I'm very pleased, but it is not my language, obviously. So the intimacy that you have with the expression when you write obviously gets lost. You have the story, you have what has happened. And perhaps the thing that I had to learn, and I learned between the two translations, is to stand back and let the translator work. Because on the first book, I interfered a lot, I'm afraid, and the result wasn't a very happy one. You know, when you start speaking a foreign language, you fall in love with particular expressions, some things that seem so beautiful that you don't have in your mother tongue, and you say, oh, I could say that, but in fact they might not mean what you think they mean, and to write in a language, I think you need to be grounded not only linguistically but with your sensitivity, and there is a depth to the words that you unavoidably lose in a foreign language, because the choice of a word echoes layers and layers of meaning that have been sedimenting one on top of the other from your childhood, and when it actually the right word comes, it's a very precise thing in your mother tongue, and you lose that unavoidably. It's not a necessary evil. It's something very good, I think, and particularly this translation, the second one, the one in which I stood back, it's, I think, a very good translation. I'm happy that I didn't interfere, because I think that Stuart Hood, who translated the book, did a wonderful work recreating and setting the story in English. Perhaps it's not faithful 100%, but it is a story that one can read from the beginning to the end without feeling, oh, this doesn't sound right. It must have been different in the original. I think that you can trust him as a writer.
To do the job. Okay, maybe you can set the picture for us.
Right.
This is your third novel.
Yes.
And it was the second to be actually translated into
English. Right. And what's happening The book is the story, it's called The Way Back, and it tells of, and it's all set during a journey from London to Rome. The protagonist and the voice, the subject who tells the story, is a psychiatrist of Polish origin. His mother was a refugee in Rome, and he has moved to England. And the chapter I'm going to read is the heart from which the whole story comes. And he's, well, I think this will come out, but it's when he's talking to his partner on the Isle of Skye, and the whole chapter is concerned with what I've been confusedly trying to hint at, this relationship between the languages and the distance between people, this distance that comes and goes. At times you feel very close in talking with somebody, at times this closeness disappears and you feel lost, and you wonder whether this is a linguistic and cultural problem or something else. Here is mainly a cultural problem. What does it mean to be different? What does it mean to be Italian and English in this case? Shall I read? Perhaps it's better, and then shall I go there? Yes.
As you please, but that's set for you.
Okay. The train had stopped at Varzo, near Domodossola. It was a summer afternoon. We had left Victoria Station the day before. That night, I had slept little and badly. Some old men were playing cards under a pergola in the courtyard of a bar behind the station. They were arguing, sometimes animatedly. I didn't catch what they were saying. I pricked my ears, but they were a long way off, behind wire netting brown with rust. I wrote in a notebook, "Dear Italy, where people talk." I lost the notebook later, but I remember this sentence because one evening, a year later, Julia read it out to me at Edinbane on the Isle of Skye. We had been wandering about for some days in the Highlands, and in all the pubs we had found men alone and silent over a pint of beer. The television set, always switched on a bracket in a corner of the room, carried news from a remote world with different lights, different climates. And the exaggerated joviality of the presenters, the quiz competitors, sellers of soap powders, journalists, politicians, a joviality which, seen from up there, had something unreal about it. These truncated figures, talking at the tops of their voices, gaudy, looked like prisoners of something more mute than silence. One can get beyond silence. One can begin to talk or to make a gesture which reaches someone. The gabbling, the jolly and slightly hysterical gabbling of these people, cuts itself off, however, wrapping itself up in a solitary logorrhea. It seemed like the remains of a world adrift, trying to find the inlet in which to disembark its army of salesmen. The men in the pub drank their beer alone, but no one watched the television, which was thus merely an amulet, a little magic shrine to modernity, put there to protect their silence, to affirm the gratuitous nature of any discourse. Not that the Scots don't like to have parties, on the contrary. They have them only on ritual occasions, at weddings, which in Caithness last 3 days. On the other hand, if someone makes the journey up there, you certainly can send them back after the wedding. Or at the splendid country Hogmanays, with the first footing, that is the first visit to the neighbors, and with people being found drunk in the fields as much as a week later, sometimes still singing, at other times frozen to death. And above all, on the long winter nights round the fire with a glass of whiskey in one's hand, telling about journeys made, reading poetry. We talked about it a bit. I told Julie about the old man at Varzo. She told me about her childhood in Scotland, how she had felt repressed and frustrated among the Puritans, and how Italy had always seemed a happy country to her. While I listened to her describing the splendid qualities of my country, I said to myself that she was biased. Other utopias were awakening in her enthusiasm. But Julia was not to be stopped. Without realizing it, I had already been caught up in her flow and was following her. Todi, Venice, even certain bars on the outskirts of Bologna took on mythical importance in her words. She had only once been to Italy on her honeymoon, but since then she had not missed a film with anything to do with Italy and had read almost all the little of our literature she could find in translation. She knew by heart many opera arias. Sorry, this is because she's an opera singer. And knew what they meant, but the sense of the things and the words with which we say them had never really come together for her. This was another reason why for some months she had begun to study Italian and now spoke with a smattering, slowly. But my country had remained a fantasy for her. The things she began to say, starting with that phrase in my notebook, was one of the first efforts she made to go beyond cautious comprehensions and the correct pronunciation of the words. She had finally entered a different region, the one round which she had spun so many fantasies and which she had in this way sought out, constructed. She seemed one of those who arrive for the first time in company of which they have a high opinion and, fearing to appear inadequate, weigh each word and each gesture until, finding something familiar, they feel at their ease, recognize their word in that other word. That phrase seemed to her something that only an Italian could say about Italy, and she was happy to understand it. She was at last on familiar terms with the oddities of my behavior, which, rightly or wrongly, she had classified as Italian. She felt superior to her old prejudices. No longer attracted by a mysterious exoticism, but in a new house. In short, she began to move around in her feeling of being Italian, to live in it. I kept at bay nostalgia for the delightful country of Julia's words, mattering, making things clear, applying the brakes. But there was also a feeling of tenderness with which I replied to her, a strange homesickness, and that was the phrase Julia had taken from my notebook and woven into her enthusiasm came from. I looked at her with surprise and suspicion. I felt I had written something banal in an excess of sentimentality. But what right had I to rob those words of the meaning she had found there in order to impose my skepticism? What right had I to say, don't be silly, look, Italy isn't like that. That phrase is mere stupidity. It is you who are making a romance of it. Does what we say not always go beyond ourselves and our opinions, in the words we exchange, in the way we behave when with others, in a no man's land where our frontiers intersect? What do we know about what we know, if not that along the way we find it, lose it, and find it again, continually? Julia kept her eyes half shut, as if she were making an effort to see her Italy in the distance, to make it closer through her imagination. And in these, she was so far ahead of me. Then she began to look at me again, seeking in my look confirmation of her fantasy. But I too, by now, was carried away by her enthusiasm, with which she imagined my country. In her enthusiasm, she projected onto me you, my Italian love, who didn't have a hard puritanical childhood, but grew up between hills covered with vines and the blue sea. And the tar which took the skin off my knees in my courtyards, the smell of cats and soup in the damp staircases of my childhood, allowed themselves to get a high from her colors. I adjusted the cushion behind my back. It was my turn to say something. Italy, I began, continuing in the tone of her story. I had always been on my guard against nostalgia for my country, as if against a fit of mourning, and remained silent for a short while, searching for words, suspended between something I had somehow lost interest in and the beautiful descriptions Julia had given of the Italy I wished to make my own. On this island, we felt far from everything. Our brief holiday had already dilated the London timetables, the hospital and the theatres. We had immersed ourselves in a time that was ours alone, in which we didn't need to answer the telephone, anyone, where we flew along together like two birds. Every so often, the window threw a handful of raindrops against the window, and we stopped to make out the noises of the rain. A car coming nearer, a door banging, the distant barking of a dog. Julia, who when talking had held her bust erect, sustained by the excitement of her story, relaxed the muscles of her back, waiting for me to begin to speak. Who knows how much of what I fell in love with in her was only the taste of the foreign country through which she drove me. Ideas about nature, society, and the universe brought to the British Isles by nomadic and warrior peoples, the Saxons, the Danes, the Celts, the Vikings, the Normans, the Picts, and naturally the Romans. Certainly the Picts bore the same relation to her as the blue sea to my courtyards. But at this point it was clear that with my clarifications, I didn't so much hold her flow at bay as my own emotion. I gave way, thought by thought, from admiration to affection, from the intellect to love. In short, I drew close to what there really was between us. An unusual transparency had been created. We talked and we looked at each other as if for the first time, but without the fear one usually has of unknown people. Shortly, we would return to a familiarity that had no contours and meshed in the exasperating shortcomings of daily life. We would begin once more to swap crazes and whims, annoyances and courtesies. But now I saw the vein of gold which I had guessed at in her one day on one of Potter's buses, and which had made me fall in love, and even the flow which one day might lose her for me. I knew very clearly why I was there with her on an island where I had neither past nor future, and it was from there that I should have liked to put things to rights. Courage, then. Don't let us rob her of a future she doesn't ask for, and which perhaps will never exist. Italy, I repeated, but didn't continue. We smiled together at this, my second embarrassed beginning. But in that silence, I saw so much road run past and was convinced she understood. I no longer wanted to say to her, don't be silly. On the contrary, in the way we smiled together, I felt our wings. Perhaps we would never be able to see them, but we were flying. No more clarifications, no suspicions, but the dense atmosphere of your friendship. But I didn't even manage to say this to you. I was afraid of drowning my hopes, of which there were so many, in excessive explicitness, and so I was silent. Once more I sought to establish a distance, confess that my passion were very banal. Pasta, red wine, there are lots like me in Italy. Then I began to tell her once more about Varzon, playing the Italian, accepting to be typecast by those traits which among fellow Italians are mocked good-humoredly. I said that this habit of talking which the Italians have is the root of provincialism which, for good or bad, characterizes us. That we often speak not to say something, but to indicate a presence. And that was how I talked too, or rather how certain things talked by themselves. Something happened to me, similar to what I had noticed in Julia when she had stumbled into her first real statement in Italian. A word that was secretly frequented began to speak. I pricked up my ears as I did that afternoon in Varzo to listen to the old man, but I was immediately lost, or perhaps rediscovered, in an unfathomable number of resemblances, differences, memories. The words called to each other and in this way spoke themselves. I didn't even manage to put names to them all, to understand how they were connected to each other. I followed them, caught up in their current. Then I went back to Varzo, to the afternoon of last summer. Even if I had been able to hear those old men, I wouldn't have understood much. The dialogues of Lombardy, you see, are incomprehensible to me. And even if I understood, if I had got off the train, had gone up to them and had begun to speak, from my accent, from the very fact of my addressing them as if of right, they would have understood that I was not from these parts and would have answered me in another language, in the Italian of school, of military service, of TV and the office. These two I had known at a certain point in my life, in Rome as a boy with my schoolmates, son of people from the Veneto, Sicily, Turin, Naples, catapulted like me into that strange Italian in which the dialects of our parents and grandparents were dying. Anyone who had a native language knew that that this was a foreign language, and anyone like me who didn't have one could not distinguish the Italian words from the remnants of dialect which wandered through our sentences. So we all spoke by trial and error, a language of fragments. The grammar we learned in school was only an hypothesis, another umpteenth language which was used in books and for elegant conversation. And yet there were no classrooms. We went to school in shifts and in packed classes, with teachers lost in their turn between the fascist education they had received and the anti-fascist Italy, which they had to teach us to love and respect. Men and women whose childhood had been swallowed up by the war and who, looking at us, often didn't know what to teach. Our real school was rather that society, unexpectedly uprooted from its provincial, peasant, and patriarchal origins, and projected into the general enthusiasm of the boom. Now I too was aware of an Italian tone, that irony about one's own misfortunes which makes us resemble each other, to say what we are thinking. Giulia and I usually didn't talk like this. The Italian voice which had wakened me turned, rushed back in haste, unconscious and enthusiastic, to find arguments and context restored to it a certain density. And at the end of that rush, I imagined a joy, or at least the end of a pain. I would have liked to tell Giulia about the park, about Livio, Nerina, about everything and everyone. Instead, I had stopped again with a lump in my throat. The Italian voice simply had not reached out to her to tell a story. It had got stuck in a hole behind the vocal cords with suffocated cries. I thought that 50 years ago, with the same superficial patriotic enthusiasm, my country would have sent me to kill Giulia, the man in that pub, while those whom I imagined to be my allies were exterminating my family in Treblinka. I spoke no more. I saw running through my head trains laden with people, the grandparents I had never known, the uncles and aunts, all those people of whom only the names remained for me. I thought of my mother, who at 16 escapes from Warsaw, not even knowing whether to the east or to the south. I thought of my religious lessons in the corridor, my mates who shouted, "Hey, Polak, pass that ball." How much I should have liked to really be a Pole sometimes. But then why speak of Italy? Did that blood not suffice me? I saw the words I had just said disperse in watery rivulets, get lost in an enclosed void within me, where all I wanted was revenge. But on whom and why? My mother had long since completely hidden all traces of her origin from our life. To be Italian always seemed to me rather obvious and accidental. Now I was confused by my strange nostalgia. The more anger brought to my lips a lament for Italy, the more intimately I was aware how painful that distance, the time and miles between me and my country, had suddenly become. What am I doing up here in the Hebrides, so far from home? Giulia was looking at me with a puzzled expression, perhaps a little bored. I felt condemned. Everything I'd lived through, the errors and attempts that had brought me up here to be what I was, had become invisible, wrapped with me in a shadow of silence. By talking, I would no longer cross the path of what she or anyone else was saying. I would have stitched onto me the hysterical chatter of someone talking to himself. I would have become one of those television sets that are left turned on in pubs. With my eyes, I measured an exasperating distance between Giulia and me. I tried to cross it with a few sentences, but all the words disappeared in my thoughts. I was afraid of not being able to hide anything anymore and of not being able to say, far less explain it. We were flying together. Now I had crashed to the ground. I had ended up by repeating for myself the walls of which I knew I have always been a prisoner. That was something else I had known and I had forgotten, not to think about Italy, not to talk about it. But what on earth could I explain to her? My life down there was lost amid memories so intense and confused that every word was deflected by them, while I was thrust further back by each of these faint words into a silent word. If something I did had offended Giulia now, I would have lost her forever. the distance that had been created between us was our radical difference, something from which we would never be free, the language in which we had learned to know the world and from which so much of us still poured forth. Certainly it was a miracle that, coming from places so far apart, our lives had crossed at a certain point, and I, who do not believe in miracles, so clearly that this meeting at that moment, as at every other, was fragile, played out on the cusp of incomprehension, of the inability to have any exchange, as if to each phrase spoken, the other could retort, "I do not understand. It all stays inside you. Nothing comes out. You are mad," thus shutting him up in his world once more. She pushed her fringe away from her eyes with another smile which said, "I do not understand," and I was missing her. She had the humble look people take on in a foreign language when they have not understood a word and indicate this without wishing to force the speaker to repeat. Let him judge whether it is worthwhile or whether we are even capable of following what he's trying to say. I was still trapped in the depths of my introverted obstinacy, which was angry and loving, but shut off, incommunicable. Juliet perhaps not noticed, perhaps she had. In any case, she was there asking me with her eyes, "I didn't understand. Do you want to try again?" "Right, I'm not a book or a television set. You can ask me, and I answer you." I remained silent for a few more seconds, holding back in my throat the shouts of protest and the words of excuse, and sought for the thread of that conversation. Varzo, the story you were pursuing, Julia, and which held together our lack of understanding. Varzo, the air was still, as often happens in Italy in the summer, the world motionless. From a window near the station, there issued a music from one of those little radios that seemed more conscious of the box full of transistors than of the music. There was also the voice of a woman singing along with the radio, probably in the same room. I leant from the window. I even think I singled out the window from which the music and voice came, the one with the shutters wide open and carpets on the windowsill. But I didn't see the woman. It was a strong voice, out of tune, young, probably annoying for everyone, but not for me. Not for me at that moment, because it spoke to me of home, of that lost fatherland, which I have wept for from the first day of my life, and which I then sought, constructed in my heart, in my language. It spoke to me of Rome, of cleaners in the blocks of flats in summers like these so many years ago, and of an arena. Into the carriage came a customs officer, who immediately calmed my feelings of nostalgia. For a moment I thought of embracing him, but I didn't have time. With almost unconsciously mechanical gesture, I had already opened my suitcase for him and now watched him rummage among my underpants. He spoke with the arrogant tone policemen adopt when they think there is something not quite right between you and the law. He must have been about 20, but I was unable to recognize the accent he had learned to disguise, at least in these rapid verbal exchanges with anonymous, authoritarian, rapid expression. "Passport? Nothing to declare?" He spoke Italian in bites, as if with each phrase he let a guillotine come down between the peasant he came from and the bureaucrat he was heading for. When he addressed me more directly, he used exclusively imperatives. "Don't worry, open these, leave it alone," without ever adding a please or thank you, not even one of those purely ritual ones to which I had become pleasantly accustomed in England. With a little regret, I thought, he was the first Italian I was seeing. I wanted to hug me, but that was out of the question. I stared at him while he searched with his head thrust into my suitcase. I was suddenly at the mercy of his whims and could not but follow every gesture of his, as if I already had the handcuffs on my wrists. In the windless air outside the train, every motorcycle engine, every banging door called me home, and the woman who was singing had begun to beat her carpets, and now I could have seen her, while from the little table with the old man, there had risen a chorus of curses and protests for a card badly played, and now one could hear every word. "Shit, damn, idiot. Is that how you play a trump?" After having meticulously taken my luggage apart, he asked me, "What sort of a job do you have?" He was clearly trying to find something not quite right about me. I got annoyed and replied, "None." I'm not sure if he would have believed I was a doctor. All I had was a face of someone who looked as if he hadn't slept all night and hadn't got rich. We looked each other in the eye for a moment. He didn't believe me, obviously, and was wondering whether to make me leave the train. Probably was weighing up whether it was worthwhile investigating or if I were only out to make trouble. I was in his hands. He could, if he wanted, now make my return to Italy very unpleasant. I too was thinking things over. I regretted having answered him in that way. I had made myself stupidly vulnerable, as if I wanted to challenge him. He had black hair and eyes, thick brows, a broken front tooth, and a large square hands with a big, scratched gold ring. He held my passport open in one hand and used it as a fan, striking it lightly on the palm of the other. I didn't know whether he would detain me, but I clearly saw another reason why I was sorry to have replied in that way. I had had my revenge. I had humiliated him. He could opt out of being a man facing a man by means of his uniform, by treating me as a criminal solely because I was crossing a frontier. I had had recourse to another kind of impersonality, that of class relations, pretending to be someone who doesn't need to work to earn his living, thus magnifying the difference there was between us when we walked along the streets in civilian clothes. I was sorry. I knew from his brusque, embarrassed manners, from his undigested mouthfuls of Italian, what an effort he must have made every morning to get into that uniform. Certainly was not from Lombardy, and who knows what story had brought him to his part of the country, in a way not so different from so many of his fellow countrymen who had come to Varzo to be customs officer, perhaps on a salary lower than theirs. Had he come into hospital in London and told me that he had strange pains in the evening, he couldn't say where, I would have let him go on speaking about the cold, the food, the people were too reserved, and would have made for him the diagnosis that he had written on his face, "You're homesick." What they had taught at the custom officer school barely masked the hostility he had felt for generations towards everyone who was not from his part of the country. He was another inadequately Italian. As we had all been at school, confronted by that mysterious language so distant from our real language, as we all were in terms of politics, faced by televisions and newspapers, always lost between that little social nucleus in which we had learned to know the world and a huge Italy where what we had learned was of little use. What a difference from the policemen of Northern Europe with their orderly frontiers, their courtiers and murderous precision. Like me, that boy had left some years before in search of a job and, alone in a country almost foreign to him, kicked against the bricks, feeling with his own arrogance his distance from the others in order to feel like the protagonist in a situation where instead he was the victim. I had betrayed him. I had chased him back into his solitude, to his off-duty walks, where his contemporaries, who do not wear a uniform even in the cut of their hair, avoided him when he was in civilian clothes as if he were an alien. I had once more presented to his eyes the graffiti on the walls that told him to go back to the South, the same things that in London told me and so many others that this was no place for us. I opened my arms. I'm not sure whether to clasp him to my heart or to beg his pardon on my behalf and on behalf of everyone that made up his life and this world. He shyly lowered his eyes, slammed my passport on my chest, and scurried into the corridor and then down off the train. I sat down. I looked once more at the old man who continued to play, surrounded now by a knot of people who followed the game in silence. On the other side of the station, a man of about 40 in shorts and t-shirt came out of a little gate on his scooter with a big bottle in a shopping net slung on the handlebars. Then the train moved. I looked at the window from which the music was coming and saw a woman pulling in a carpet. We went past other houses, high and low, and almost at once the countryside began. This country, which is painfully mine, had left some years before with my head full of ideas, mostly confused ones. Did I know what was hidden away in my departure? Certainly, if I ever did, I could not say to myself. The baggage from those years was too heavy. I probably talk about curiosity and openings rather than about terrorism and unemployment. Not that, now that I was returning, I had clearer ideas about what I was doing. If anything, I had got used to a certain state of not knowing. And then there was you, Julia. So I was coming back to Italy, but I was leaving London. Julia lay down at my side, took the watch from the bedside table and showed it to me. It was 3 in the morning. She said something else in English this time, which I don't remember exactly, but the sense of which was something like this. The past is always morning. It is dead, finished. Youth are roots yesterday. But today we are talking, and it is precisely that death which has set us free in the present, capable of loving, fighting, even of feeling regret without being sucked far away from things. This is Edinburgh today. And then she said in Italian, so you see we aren't strangers. And her voice, still uncertain over the phonetics of my language, with double vowels, misplaced fricatives, a glottal stop which had exploded in her mouth as if in a Germanic language, crossed all frontiers. It was the language of all those many boys with whom I had been a boy, who didn't know how to speak Italian, and in my heart, it was as the ancient lyric says, just here in my heart, Eros gave shape to Eleodora, who talked sweetly to me, soul of my soul. She was my house, my country, she who each day was more at home in this other house of mine, my language, Italian. She had already shut her eyes and turned out the light. She was falling asleep quickly. I thought anew of the train, which goes through the green Lombard countryside, among the ranks of poplars, amid the smell of cut grass, to find my friends again, some streets I haven't seen for so long, and that bar at Sant'Eustachio, where once upon a time they made good coffee. Who knows if that place is still there? Right, this is this.
Feels as if you've done something.
Yes,
got through that.
It's a great achievement for me to read it in English. I hope something got through.
Well, nobody was falling asleep from here. I was able to check, so I assume it did. Now, we do have a little bit of time, and I was wondering whether you would like, having taken a sip of water, to read maybe just a page from your latest book, which is not translated into English yet.
In Italian.
So it would have to be in Italian.
Is it?
I see people nodding, so I understand that either they will understand you or they will at least follow you. But maybe you can give us again a feeling for where we are and what is going on.
Yes, well, I'll read something very short. Very short, yes, because yes, this is at the end of the last novel that I published in April. It's called Le colpevole ambiguità di Herbert Marcus, which I would translate in English. The Guilt and Ambiguities of Herbert Marcus. Herbert Marcus is a professor of history who has received a commission from an American publisher to write a fast book on Europe after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And he's in Rome to read a paper when the book begins, to read a paper about plots, about conspiracies. Because of the transformation of the context in which he is, the fact that he is a man, it's quite typecast, he's a man of the left who has grown in working for the state, working for the university, and all of a sudden receives this great sum of money, which makes him tremble a bit, makes him doubt about his allegiance. Not that he changes his mind, but also the reference points around him have gone. He doesn't. There's no longer any Russia. There's no longer. He was never Philo-Russian, but he let's say he's lost ideologically, and he's also lost personally. because he has been abandoned by his wife, who comes from Eastern Europe, a couple of years before. And he has the impression that he has seen her in Rome. So all the pain of persecution that he has, of having the MI5 after him for some reason or another, is a real one or a false one. And this is the thriller that I used to build the story. But then there is a reflection that runs through the book on history and materialism, which are the very fabric of what he has been culturally. He's always been a materialist, and all of a sudden he finds that he has too many facts to talk about, too many things, and he feels that there is a limit in understanding the world through history. He needs something else. And the page that I'm going to read is at the end, where I'm not telling you what has happened, but he has a dream. He dreams that he's in Athens, and he's following Socrates with the other young Athenians, listening to erudite and complicated discussions that he doesn't completely follow. But he tries to be part of the group and hoping not to be asked anything. But in this dream, a young man asks him something, and he doesn't know what to reply. And all of a sudden, he sees in the distance two angels. And they look at him and then fly away. The group with Socrates moves on without him having given an answer. And he realizes that he has desired, as he has seen these angels, to follow them. And that there is this drive which he cannot fly. He knows that even in his dreams he cannot fly behind the angels, but that these angels are going, and that there is something in him which would like to overcome these difficulties by flying and following the angels. It's just one page. Nei giorni in cui can I read from here so I'll be more Nei giorni in cui infuriava la discussione sulla sua colpevolezza e si chiedeva come potesse spiegare, aveva sognato due angeli seduti sopra una pietra nella placa di Atene. Dalla cima della collina, la testa della statua di Atena spuntava dal Partenone, illuminava il mondo dei traffici umani e guardava il mare, le isole, le navi. Lui camminava con un gruppetto di ragazzi e di uomini dietro Socrate e si discettavano questioni complicate, finissime, che lui non capiva. C'era un giovane saputello che a un certo punto lo indicava per chiedergli di spiegare ed Herbert inspirava imbarazzato, alzava il naso pieno di ansia, rivelava la propria ignoranza. I sapienti lo avrebbero mandato via. Allora vedeva gli angeli seduti su un sasso che lo guardavano senza dir nulla e poi volavano via. Herbert nel suo sogno desiderava volare dietro a loro, lasciarsi indietro le difficoltà terrene e partecipare con le creature alate di un mondo più terso, dove l'esistenza è già giustificata e non è necessario spiegare chi si è e perché si è fatto in quel modo. Lo desiderava e non ci riusciva. Gli uomini sapienti riprendevano a camminare lui con loro, lui come loro, a chiedere e rispondere. Solo nell'immaginazione spiccava quel volo, con un movimento interiore che gli era familiare, un volo alto come un canto. La tensione a superare il presente veniva però frustrata. Doveva restare a terra, ripreso per un piede, ancorato al corpo e al tempo. Questo sogno rimase con Herbert anche quando tornò la calma, il ritmo di occupazioni più o meno inutili che gli avevano portato via una buona parte della vita tra biblioteche metropolitane. Guardava Sdena e gli sembrava incredibile aver dubitato tanto. Con la felicità e l'infelicità che c'era stata, il loro era stato un destino comune. La guardava seduta in cucina a sfogliare una rivista, o ridere per un episodio insignificante della loro giornata, un refuso comico su un giornale, la tenerezza di un animale, e si sentiva attratto, come nel suo sogno, a seguire in volo i suoi accenni, a ridere con lei, filando attraverso sottili fenditure di senso che si aprivano tra le banalità come tra i rami di un bosco. essere con lei era seguire l'angelo che lo portava fuori dal sé. Ecco, basta.
Okay, I'd only like to say that that's not the very end of the book.
No, it's not.
And I do sincerely hope it's going to be translated, because I think it's a book that would do very well in England and in English as well. So, right, we have time for questions. So if you would like to start firing things at Enrico, I'm sure he'll be
firing
more than happy to answer. firing questions. Anywhere around? Yes.
Well,
shall I repeat that quickly? Because sometimes at the back you can get it. So the question is, you use English and you use Italian. Which is, you think, the most effective language for literary communication?
Well, I have a dream that is... Oh, sorry, I keep dreaming of that. last week we had a very beautiful conference at UCL on plurilinguism. Who have worked a lot on romantics and the identity between culture and language, and explained very often to my students what an utopia it has been to have the two coming together, woke up last week in front of a representative of the European Commission for Plurilinguism to the fact that we are in a completely different age in which this identification of culture and language probably means nothing anymore. I mean, it means it can be used obviously in novels, but we're probably entering an epoch in which there will be many languages. I mean, if you are in London, like for instance my eldest son is in a school where there are probably 70 or 80 mother tongues, and the fact that he's bilingual, that at first I thought would have been an handicap for him in English, in England, it came out to be in that school not particularly an handicap, because compared to the otherness of the boys in that school, is after all, is an European, is much closer to the power, if you want, to what it takes to. And therefore, my dream is that there will be less and less this problem, and that we'll have languages like the one in which Dante wrote or Shakespeare wrote, which were not so set in their ways, but were very permeable. Can you say that? Very receptive of, for instance, Dante pays homage to, as you know, to Provençal in the Commedia, or Shakespeare very often and very willingly uses expressions that are shaped by a spoken English, which is very, very, how do you say, crossed by several influences. And obviously, I mean, and in a more banal way, I think that the answer is that probably for an Italian writer, today it's still easier, for me it's better to write in Italian, as for an English writer it's better to write in English, but hopefully, I think that not only we will have more and more novels that will cross these frontiers and will talk about our relationship with each other, which I think is very important, but also the language sooner or later will start to respond to that. For instance, I have some the syntactical problem that I mentioned before. I no longer have on these problems the same normative approach that I used to have, whereas I used to feel ashamed and I thought, and to think that unfortunately I had to leave, I had to come to this country, and therefore my language was somehow broken and interfered with by English. Now I'm quite happy that this has happened, because I think it's a push and a contribution that I can give. And I hope the same will happen with English and with French, and that the styles, when we'll be talking about styles in 20 years' time, in 30 years' time, we will start seeing surfacing more and more of these influences. Well,
Can I just ask, was that clear to everybody? You heard that quite clearly. Looks as if you did. Okay.
Right. The autobiography or the biography that I use, even in my first book, which I thought was just the account, the journal of something that had happened, and it's the only book in which I actually use autobiographic material. For instance, this journey never happened, this journey between London and Rome, or this event in the Isle of Skye, they never happened. I try to create the impression of autobiography in order to come to call my reader closer, to create the impression that I'm talking about what has happened and that this is, to create this illusion of, there is a compulsion. I mean, I need to talk about these things, but the autobiographical register, so to speak, is fictional. I do not write about, I never write, all the writing is invented, and it needs to be in order to release me from the shyness that I would obviously feel. I mean, I would never write anything like the pages I've written if I had actually had gone through them, if you understand what I mean. If it would be something personal and private, and my partner would hate me for publishing something like that. I mean, why should I make money out of something that happened to both? And why don't you say this and that that happened that evening? Or this, in fact, I learned painfully with the first novel, where the girl I talked about reacted in this way, and quite rightly. I mean, she was at first very, 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 very angry that I talked about us and I published this book. Then eventually things, I mean, we're very good friends now, but there was certainly a very bad moment. So it's partly because, perhaps I was then pushed towards developing these false, can I say false autobiography? Or rather, I'll answer you as Kundera is answered in an interview that I really like. I really like his answer. He says that you cannot ask a writer about his biography because his books are the undoing of his biography. You see, I'm talking about obviously things I are very dear to my heart, but I cannot use the events or what has happened because it gets in the process of writing transposed and so that you can actually say it. I'll give you an example which I use a lot when I try and explain what is this kind of constriction. I have a dear friend, a Venetian friend. It's a real story, who told me this story. He went to see a schoolmate of his, who was one of these boys who always cracks jokes and had this public persona of a funny boy, somebody who always tells jokes. And the mother of this boy had died, and my friend went to see him on that very day to pay his respect, to give his condolences. And this person said, "Ah, Giulio, thank you very much. Come and sit down, and I have to tell you a joke. Dracula goes to see Frankenstein, and Frankenstein invites him for dinner and prepares a spezzatino, which is a dish with bits of meat and potatoes. And whilst eating, Dracula says, 'Oh, but this is wonderful, this is really beautiful, what meat is it?' And Frankenstein answers, 'You know, di mamma ce n'è una sola, there is only one mother.' And my friend was taken aback, saying, 'On the day his mother dies, he tells me something like that.' But then thinking of this person, he realized that the public persona that he had built, the reputation for being a cracker of jokes, obstructed him from saying what he wanted to say, what was really that phrase. The phrase was sincere. Di mamma ce n'una sola, there is only one mother. But he couldn't say it like that. He needed to create this artificial situation in which he could say that phrase. Well, I think that fiction is a bit like that. Fiction, you are genuinely compelled to talk about things like, for instance, for me to talk in this book about being away, being afar, learning to live with people who speak another language and who not only speak, because the language, as I think, I hope you have understood in this chapter, is just the surface of a difference. But I wouldn't be able to explain it if I was faithful to reality. I need to create another level in which I move characters, and they articulate what I mean. And I project on, and sometimes, and if the book works, if it takes off, you're no longer aware of these. The characters seem to live a life of their own. Obviously, you keep projecting, but this becomes unconscious. You follow them. They do things that you would never do in real life. They kill, they follow, there are events that are dramatic, that are fictional. But these, because you have set up this situation, if it works, it articulates what you're actually concerned with.
It's interesting what you're saying, because one of the characters in your second novel, which is Ages Apart, or Pietro il Sale, has actually got this problem of how to districate his biography and the feeling of using up people and material and so on from the creative process.
Absolutely.
How to not feel guilty, or how to not feel that he is exhausting life, in a sense, by using it up in creation. So
And he has to become aware that the two things part.
Jeremy, you were going to...
The situation is much better. I mean, when I arrived in this country, there was really just Corrado Alvaro, Moravia, very, very little. But after the success of The Name of the Rose, there are quite a lot of books translated. Particularly, this publisher has done a wonderful job, which is Serpent's Tale, has published Celati, who's a very good writer, I think, has published Tondelli, who I think is an important writer. And the problem is rather another, which is, I wouldn't blame it on the publishers. The problem is I was looking at the 100 bestseller of last year in The Guardian, and there's not one single author who is not Anglo-Saxon. There's not even Milan Kundera, who I think is one of the best writers of his generation, and nothing at all. It's a problem that, I think is stronger probably in some part of the country than in others. But and the reason why they're translated, this is a difficult one. Probably there is now in the international book trade a sort of computer system by which you immediately translate something that is successful. So you have Coelho or, I don't know, Eco indeed, or writers who have been selling very much, and you try it, or Susanna Tamaro, or Baricco. Regardless, they might be good writers, bad writers, doesn't matter. The important is that you try to put them out as soon as possible, and trying to, how do you say, take the wake of the sales in the country of origin. It is very difficult to say why writers who are not translated are not translated. I know very well also the other problem, translating some writers for whom I have a lot of admiration in Britain. Then in Italy we translate a lot of English literature. But for instance, I failed to have Rosalind Belben translated, who I have a lot of time for, and is published now by Serpent's Tale. Sells very little in England too, but has a wonderful language and a wonderful way of weaving, which is what I really like in literature, of being able to weave together narrative and reflection and thought. But there are some very good writers that we translate, but not for good reasons. Like, for instance, Ian McEwan is doing very, very well in Italy, but I'm afraid not because of is not translated because his qualities, I'm very cynical about the reasons why publishers do book in general. And somebody was asking me, they always ask me, how do you get translated in the first place? And that is a big mystery. As you know, for instance, my publisher in Italy receives something like 2,000 unsolicited manuscripts a year. And there are not even the money to pay for reading these manuscripts. So it's really a lucky opening that you have to get into. And the same thing goes for translations. I mean, it doesn't depend on the quality of what you have, but on... I feel that publishers, by and large, are gamblers. They are around a roulette table and they're trying to see 36. Let's try it and see what happens. It sells or it doesn't. But very rarely they have a real editorial policy. Serpentsdale has. In Italy, Feltrinelli has, I think, although one that I don't particularly like, but they have a policy. But most of them are just gambling. I mean, with.
Fact remains, I don't know if everybody knows it, but Italy is the country that translates most overall, worldwide. And English is the language that, in a percentage, I mean, in relative terms, that does it least.
It's strange because English people are usually good gamblers, aren't they?
Should be. One more, that's it. We'll take one more and then close, I think. There was one behind you, I'm afraid, before you.
One question. You know, in the way back, you talked about the importance of cultures, and yet you choose a Polish and Italian. Which seems to throw in another, span of works between two cultures coming together. What possesses you?
Right. Yes. This is very important. Because... The reason why I left Italy, but the reason why this character leaves Italy is because of the terrorism in Italy at the end of the 70s. He's not responsible, but is very much under pressure to leave. And I didn't want to make of him just a political exile. He's not a political exile. What I wanted to create is a continuity of uprootedness. This goes back to what I was saying, hoping that in 20 years' time there will be more cross-cultural influences. What I wanted was a character who had a history of being uprooted. His problem is not so much to understand why did I come away. His problem is to understand that there is a sort of not belonging which is inherent to the human being. To this idea of going, and this is why I'm so strongly anti-fascist. I mean, I'm jumping a lot of passages, but the reason why I'm so strongly anti-fascist, and I think fascism is unfortunately an Italian malady and not a chance, but something that from time to time recurs, unfortunately. And this is because sometimes when they feel lost, Italians tend to go back to this idea of nationality and create a false Italianness, which is compulsive and painful and repressive. My mother has a Serbo-Croat surname. She's called Petrovic. And during the war, her family, like most Italian families with an Italian surnames, was put under pressure to change this surname into Di Pietro, which would be now a very popular surname, very fashionable. And they resisted this. But the pressure was so strong of feeling that, and her family was a family of Greek Orthodox who had converted, this was already given in to fascism, converted to Catholicism, but maintained some difference. After the war, she married immediately an officer from Tuscany, which was her answer to this feeling aloof, feeling separated, and going back towards Italianness. So I feel that this is the Italianness that I wanted to undo. If you want, it's also very personal, and this is this idea that if you undo the influences that you had from other things, if you recreate a pure Italian, a pure language, a pure but the same goes for Frenchness or for Englishness or whatever. If you go back to this different, to your roots, and you are faithful to those roots, you find some sort of identity. I think this is a consolation that I repel. I think that on the contrary, we have to be ready in life to go through change, to understand, to have the ability to interact with the people we have around, not lament the fact that before immigration, England or Italy were a different place, were better places because there were no immigrants. This is the big problem, as you know, that we're facing today. But to have the courage and the hope for beauty, I would say, of understanding the way we're changing and being present in this world of transformations and not go back towards this national identity that for Italy in particular, England would have more ground for it, but for Italy it's been very arbitrary. It has been fascism for us. It's been this compulsion to create an Italianness which didn't really exist and came apart after the war in a rather dramatic way. If you know Italian history today, you know that the big problem we have is exactly this, the way to articulate these differences that have been put under the umbrella of Italianness. And we have the League in the North and so on, but this becomes another.
Okay, well, if anybody wants to know more about the story of this this Italian Hall and what goes with it, we do have some copies of the book that Enrico was reading from, i.e. the English translation of La Via del Ritorno, The Way Back, and I'm sure you'll be happy to sign them if that's
course.
Requested. in the meantime, can we thank you again?
Thank you for having me.
Extremely interesting and very pleasant as well. Thanks.